this study session to order, I would like to take a moment to thank our student musicians from Creighton Middle School and their director, Michelle Ewer, for what was quite a wonderful quintet performance. And those young people are only in middle school. I thought it was incredible. So. We have on our first item, our study session item this evening, an update on student-based budgeting. The Board of Education received an overview of the SBB initiative implemented last school year in 2015-16 and requested an update on how things are going in the current year. And then discussion will provide some details on changes to SBB this year from last year, as well as insights into the implementation of SBB by school principals. So with that, Mr. McMenemy, do you have anything to add to that introduction?
No, I do not. Thank you for letting us do this presentation.
Okay. So welcome, Ms. Askelson, Mr. Elliott. I'm going to let you introduce all the people that are here at the table with you. All familiar faces and talented people I know, but I'm going to let you guys take care of that, okay?
And I told them that there would be a vote for more money for schools. That's why they were willing to show up tonight. So I think we wanted to make sure we had good numbers for us.
Okay. That's a pretty good strategy, Terry. I understand strategy. Well done.
Thank you. So we'll start down there with Ms. Kirksey if you want to introduce yourself, and then we'll get started on a few slides and get to our conversation.
Jen Kirksey, Principal, Dunstan Middle School.
Wendy Dorn, Principal, Carmody Middle School.
Susie Thompson from the Budget Office.
Kathleen Askelson.
Terry Elliott.
Wesley Paxton, Conifer High School.
Tracy Jett, Mount Carbon.
And I'm Matt Cormier. I'm the principal at Wilmot Elementary.
Welcome to all of you. Please go ahead, Mr. Elliott.
Thank you, President Mitchell. So tonight what we want to do is kind of revisit the why behind SBB in our schools, talk a little bit about the enhancements for the upcoming budgeting cycle, and then really give you an opportunity to talk to the folks that are doing the work of SBB on a daily basis. I'm sure you have a lot of questions that are directly related to how this is working at the school level, and I think these are the experts when we get to the school level with us at the table tonight. So we have a few brief comments, and then we'll get to your questions as well. Just as a reminder, and regrounding ourselves, SBB is about giving control to resources closest to where those resources are being deployed. So those individuals that are building the improvement plans for their schools and identifying the needs of their student populations as well as the priorities of their communities are best positioned to make decisions on how to allocate resources. That really is the driving force behind SBB. We've looked at it as three key bullets: flexibility, equity, and transparency. And I'll share with you, I was at a school today, and I asked Sharon if I could. I was at Green Mountain Elementary School, and I said, can I quote you tonight? And she gave me permission, so she knows that I was going to talk about this. But she was sharing with me. We ran into one of her staff members in the hall. The staff member is a teacher that they were able to hire who is focused on enrichment, so addressing the advanced learning plans of students in their schools and identifying students who need enrichment and extension and can go deeper or further faster. They were able to, through SBB, identify the need in their building and be able to secure that resource to meet those needs, which is very unique. That's not a position we have at the district. We have resource teachers which consult with classroom teachers, but not actually there doing the actual instruction. Not a resource that they would ever have obtained from a central model, because we didn't see that across the district. I was going to say nationwide, and we don't really worry about nationwide, but across the district. So that's that part of flexibility. Again, the big aspect, and you might hear about it tonight, is a little bit about transparency. Depending on when budget cuts had hit over in our history, some of those remained in place at schools, and others were adjusted as dollars and funding changed with ebbs and flows in our state or district level budgeting process. With this, there's that transparency because everybody is getting a dollar amount that then they get to choose how they use that money at their local building. So in the past, we'd had situations where some schools had two secretaries allocated to them, and another school might have 1.5 secretaries allocated to them, although they had grown over time to be about the same size. Because we had never adjusted some of those situations, it led to inequitable situations in staffing as well as a lack of transparency in how those decisions were made. We believe both of those are addressed through the new process.
Okay, so for a little bit of history of SBB here, it all really started in our 2012-2013 school year, formally. We conducted that spring a panel group meeting with various principals on what we were then calling flexible staffing. And so this was just running through scenarios and building a model like we have now for SBB, but working through it with principals, getting their feedback, looking at different pieces that they would want to be responsible for, not be responsible for. So the work really began in the spring of 13. Then in 2014-15, we had a pilot group of principals, or of schools. Nine schools participated in a flexible staffing pilot. It was pretty much the same thing that SBB went into, but we focused with those nine individual schools. Then in 15-16, we went full-blown SBB. So all of our neighborhood schools and then our three option schools that are more budgeted and staffed more like neighborhood schools, so Denison, Manning, and Devlin, were also included in that. In 16-17, so this current school year, we restructured our SBB model based on feedback from principals. We knew that there was still some places that some demographics or school demographics that were struggling, so we readjusted the model to focus on those. And we also introduced SBB to the remaining option schools. They have a modified SBB right now. And now we're working on 17-18, so currently the principals are all budgeting for next year. They'll be doing that the whole month of January. And we changed the model again to add a couple new, or some new size factors, and then we've introduced plateau funding. So with SBB 3.0, that's what we're calling the 17-18 model, we enhanced our size factors. So last year we had size factors for our smaller schools. We've added more size factors to small schools, but we've also included size factors for our large schools. So our elementary has gone from 3 size factors to 15, middle has gone from 2 to 12, and senior's gone from 3 to 12. So we have a lot more factors along the way. And then we've introduced what we're calling plateau funding. So in our old model, as schools shifted in enrollment, they would shift size factors. When you would grow, you would lose that size factor, and in essence, you would fall off a cliff. You would lose funding. So what we've done now is, as you grow, you remain flat at that funding until you hit a certain point, and then you start to grow again.
So as you can tell, we continue to revise and enhance it based upon the feedback we're getting from school leaders, and that's why the plateau funding this year was introduced, as well as the additional size factors to help with some of that work. That's working to the benefit of the system as a whole, but it's a give and take at the individual school level. But we believe it's in the best interest of the schools to perform that kind of equity adjustment throughout, of which you all have a summary sheet that we provided in your folders on that. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Cormier to kind of start the process of sharing some of the stories of SBB at the local level, and then we'll move to your questions.
Well, thank you for having us this evening. I appreciate being here and being able to share a couple of messages. I think I would start off by telling you that if we were going to write a headline for a newspaper, it would be SBB, Positive Game Changer. That's what it is. And so I want you to have that in your mind, that it really has been a game changer for schools. And then the other things I want you to think about is that you're going to hear from colleagues here that it is collaborative, it is proactive, and it is flexible. And so let me start off with collaborative. The process for schools starts in December, where we have our building leadership teams prioritize how we should spend our budget. We then take it to our school accountability committees. We will review it again in January, because at that point we have seen the initial numbers and we can begin to plan for next year. Now that leads me right into proactive. because my first year as principal at Wilmot, I came in August and we realized we had some large numbers in our younger grades. And we realized that it wasn't best for kids. We needed to adjust, and so I asked my community soup to go to bat for me. And she told me, just wait, I'm gonna do it, I'm gonna fight for you, and she did. She fought for me in a room with a limited number of FTE and got us a 0.5, which I was thankful for, so thankful, because you have no idea of the parent complaints that will come when your class sizes are so large. But we were able to do great things for kids that year. Now the difference between that and SBB. In SBB, when that came into play, in February, March, and April, I was able to collaboratively work with my school community to say, we can see these large numbers aren't going away. Well, what are we gonna do? Let's reduce class sizes. And that's what people in December say. The first priority, reduce class sizes, is what our community wants. And so we can plan for that early in the spring. I'm going to tell you what happened this year in August, 5 days before school started, when the teachers came back. We realized we were in trouble with large class sizes again at our upper grades. And you think, 2 years prior to that, I would have been begging my community superintendent to arm wrestle it out with somebody in a room to get us a 0.5. No, that's not the case with SBB. With SBB, I was able to make a decision with my school community. Again, it's collaborative, to make sure that we had the staffing to hit the ground running on the first day. We have a limited number of days with kids. Let's maximize them. I was able to maximize those days by having the staffing in place. You're going to hear from other folks here about the flexibility. I will just quickly say that one of the things we were able to do is look at our UIP needs around reading and writing and say, we're going to buy some extra time to allow somebody with that skill set to meet kids' needs. So we were able to intervene for a group of kids. So again, it's a game changer. It is collaborative, it is proactive, and it is flexible. I'll turn things over to Tracy.
All right, thank you, Matt. Many of the things what Matt just said, I would reiterate the same as well. What SBB allows for me to do, which is valuable, which unlike in years past, is getting the input from my community at my school, being not just the parents and the staff members, but everyone together, as to saying, what does that look like? So I take them through a protocol to find out. I kind of think I know what the needs are, but I want to hear what they think the needs are as well. So getting that input from the teachers and grounding ourselves in is, what is our mission? What's the purpose of us coming here every day? And then on top of that, how does it match our UIP and the work that we are doing? So prior to getting into the protocol, I go around and I talk to the staff members, because we talk about FTE. I kind of take it in two parts. One is the FTE and the people factor. And then I look at the material pieces, and saying, how do we align our budget? And I really make sure I want to talk to the people, because they are an art, music, or PE teacher, or a digital teacher librarian. They're singletons sometimes. So I want to prepare them before the meeting. So then we enter into a dialogue and to get input from staff. And I use that same type of protocol with parents in December as well. So the protocol is spend a buck. So I brought visuals. And basically, to get input, we talk about every one of them. Like for my AMPS teachers, we are a 2.0 school for FTEs. Do you want to see an increase to 2.5? So do you want me to spend the money there? Or do you want to be a 3.0? Then I go to the class sizes. So I do this for all the FTEs, and then I leave blank papers. So we don't have a assistant principal. Would you want one of those? So I put what we have in place, we dialogue through it, and then they get to make decisions. So there were 10 FTE positions, and they got 6 dots only. So they were limited. So I can see where their priority spending monies are. So you can see in these two, they're completely different. But then when I came to the parents and did the exact same thing, the parents, if I just did the first two, and they kind of mirror one another, there's fewer parents that showed up. I had 22 staff members and probably 6 parents that showed up that night. So the AMPS again, along with the class sizes. So I was able to compare that, and I did the same thing with material goods. There are 9 sheets of paper where I like high ticket items, staff development, technology, copier costs, and gave them only 4 dots. And once again, they had to prioritize where they would put the money. In the end, all of it aligned to our UIP and our mission statement. What do we do every day that best supports our kids? And that's how the decision was made to prioritize. In doing so, then when I'm building the budget, I can look at projected enrollments, but also going, oh, I got an increase in students that I was not projected out. So it allowed me in a timely fashion in August to look at my budget and hire new teachers in first and third grade because it was flexible. I didn't have to ask for the approval, and we didn't have to arm wrestle to say, how do we support? Because it is the people equity and the training that goes into how we spend our money to best support our kids. So, and then another piece, just kind of looking forward, is in this year a big piece of flexibility is looking at mental health, and both on the parent and the staff is saying we really want to increase mental health at our school. So I'm going to be doing everything within my budget to say how can I increase mental health from a 0.5 FTE to a full-time FTE in the parameter so I get to play within that budget to see if it can work. And I'm pretty excited to say I think it's going to work. I have to finish the budget process. But that input from the parents and the staff and allowing me to have that flexibility to match what we do best for kids is important with SBB.
Thank you.
Talking about Conifer High School, I'm about over 800 students, about 830 students at Conifer High School. And the neat thing about Conifer High School, we're a very high-performing school. We have 21 AP courses. We have multiple honors courses, STEM, CT coursework, electives. We want to make sure our students have the opportunity to take advantage of all the courses we have offered. So we're a comprehensive high school, but a small comprehensive high school.
Excuse me, Wes. Would you pull that mic just a little closer? I think the audience will hear you better.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we start the process by really looking at what are our students' needs, both in the courses they want to choose. So we start that process in December of having the kids select their courses for the following year. And the reason we do that is because the SBB process is in January, so we want to make sure we are able to staff and build a master schedule to meet their needs. And then what we do is move into looking with working with the department managers. We meet with them to discuss, okay, here's what the students are selecting. Here's what the course offerings look like. How do we want to staff the schedule to meet their needs? And so we go through that process of looking at our number of staff we want to hire or retain at the school. And then we look at working with the SAC, the School Accountability Committee, to look at what are our priority needs on the UIP. And so if it's looking at reading, which is our focus right now, how do we want to support that within our budget needs also. So we look at both the students' needs as far as the courses they need, but also what are their learning needs and making sure that we prepare them for the next step. And so with the SBB process, we're able to really be strategic in our hiring and way we support our coursework and the offerings we have to our students. And sometimes we have to be a little bit creative in doing that. And I have had to reach out to hire some retired folks who are willing to work part-time because I don't have enough sections to offer for a full-time teacher, but I can offer a part-time position. And then also, too, looking at our learning needs of our students, being able to hire a literacy coach to work with our students, making sure that we're helping those kids, especially in 9th and 10th grade, which is really important to make sure that we help them increase their reading abilities in preparing for the 11th and 12th grade. So we were able to take those resources, allocate to hire a literacy coach to help support those students' needs. And so it's very collaborative. It's also very equitable in how we do that, and it's also very flexible in making sure we can meet those needs. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. So what I would like to do is share with you our best practice in the process that we follow over at Carmody. We start with the PTA and the SAC, and we share a body of data with them that it highlights the achievements of students, some district and state tests. We talk about what we think our needs might be. We ask for them, based off of that data, what they see our needs as being, and then we move forward with those recommendations. After that meeting, we meet with our PPST, which is our professional problem-solving team. This is a group of 12 individuals that were nominated by their colleagues, teachers in the school. that then get the same information shared with them, the information from the PTA and the SAC, and then they make some decisions and recommendations. After that, we meet with our instructional leaders in the building, and we share with the same information and get their feedback. After that, we take all four groups and we collect them, and we have a breakfast and budget meeting with our community where we invite over 800 students and their families to the meeting, and we allow just open conversation to take place, walk through the same data, same information. Where do we need to target our dollars? Where do we need to target our resources in general? It's been so far a really positive experience. What I've noticed is that when parents get involved in this process, they stay involved throughout all processes in the school. So I'm seeing an increased attendance to our PTA meetings, increased attendance to even our events. So it's been phenomenal from that standpoint. We were able to really adjust our SBB to add and increase a 0.5 math teacher to shrink the class sizes down to a place where students could be more individualized in their learning. That was a target on our UIP to increase our math scores, and so it was definitely aligned directly with the UIP. In regards to some other interesting information, you know, we noticed through our data process that 20 of 24 of our kids that had 4.0 GPAs at our school were involved in our arts programs. That's a really big, data point that we pushed and definitely highlighted. It's a celebration point. And so with that information, we wanted to also adjust our TE to make sure that FTE, so that we could increase options. We were turning kids away from those classes because they were full. And so we wanted to make sure we were able to increase the options and be more equitable with what kids could reach those classes and get into those classes in the 2 years.
Good evening. This is just my second year at Dunstan Middle School, so I kind of go at this from a little bit different direction. So when I got the position at Dunstan, coming in, the budget was basically set. I know that most middle schools that are about the size of Dunstan, which is about 640 students, a lot of middle schools that size have two assistant principals. So I think that in pre-SBB days, that Dunstan probably you would have been set, all right, you're going to have one principal, you're going to have two assistant principals, you're going to have a coach, this is how many teachers you get, and that's usually how things would be rolled out from the district. So with SBB, I was able to take a look at that and say, you know, I think that we would be fine with one assistant principal because I'm walking into a building that was woefully bereft in technology, and that was one thing that we absolutely needed. So what we did was we went ahead and went forward with just one assistant principal, and that gave us the flexibility and the freedom to take that money that normally would have been spent on an assistant principal and take that money and spend it on technology and also spend it on additional FTE. So we were able to bring in another computer science teacher to teach coding. We had three teachers at the seventh grade level for language arts, and there was a mandatory seventh grade writing class at the time that I got there that was in place. So we kind of watched that class for a year and really felt that that money would be better spent if we kept that teacher. We dissolved the writing class because we weren't seeing the kind of results that we thought that we should be able to get out of a course like that. So instead of getting rid of that FTE, we went ahead and kept that teacher and that FTE. We reduced the sizes of the seventh grade language arts classes, but then what we also did was we took two sections of that FTE and went to those three teachers and said, if you could teach your 100% total passion in language arts, what would it be? And so then we put in a multicultural lit elective class, a creative writing elective class, and an avid readers elective class. And so instead of just having your typical AMP electives, we also then started bringing in some core electives in with that. And actually, in just looking at the MAP data over the last couple of days from the fall to winter MAP data, we have had massive growth with students in those three elective language arts classes. So having the flexibility now next year, because of the growth in the Green Mountain area is fairly exponential, whether or not, sixth grade, we know that we're going to have more students no matter what. So now, this year, we have the flexibility to say, okay, in order for us to project into and be prepared for the future for more students just from the growth of the Green Mountain area. Now we are going to add an assistant principal for next year in anticipation of just more growth. But having the flexibility to be able to do that and having that assistant principal money to basically turn around and buy technology and to add teachers and programs positioned us where we really wanted to be and really met the needs of the students in the school and the areas where we wanted to see growth.
So as you can hear through this conversation, it's about what's best for kids and how do we best deliver those needs for kids. So I think the what I would close with is what we're seeing is SBB is very kid-centric, and it's yielding also benefits to the adults, as you heard, being able to teach a passion as an elective class and that academic achievement that followed that because of that passion that's coming from the instructor to the student. The students pick up on it, and it's contagious, and we see good results. So with that, we would open it up to your questions for the panel as you have. Thanks.
Okay. First, a year ago, I shared with the board and others the questions I was asking during my school visits. And one of those questions was, how are you all doing under this program this year? And the message I received in many of the smaller schools was one, if we get to a certain number, if we go over that by two, then suddenly we drop off. I think that that's the plateau solution that you're talking about, so I want you to expand on that a little bit. The other is that as you talked about growing schools and the advantages that that scenario presents under this program, because you can then start using extra resources to do problem solving. The message I heard in the smaller schools and those that are facing shrinking populations or, in instances, flat populations, it's just a small flat, they were barely able to get to the minimums, much less talk about problem solving. And so I want to have you address how we're dealing with the small school challenge under the program.
So two factors this year that are working jointly to address some of that smaller school issue. The first is eliminating the cliff, right? So that helps some of those smaller schools that could have accepted a few more students and grown a little bit, but then they would have dropped and lost funding. So that hurts them because then they don't have those families in for the next several years to grow upon each subsequent year. By going to that plateau approach, it's now behooves them to go ahead and accept those families and take on as many as their building will accommodate or they've set as their desired capacity within that building. So hopefully over time, that's kind of a multi-year as those additional families and then some additional families come in. The other thing is we did cost shifting, might be the way I would phrase it, from larger schools. So what you'll see this year is we focused last year on as you got small school funding pluses, and then you hit a point at which we start to take money back from larger schools because we believe their fixed costs spread over a larger student population enables them to meet their needs at a less per pupil amount than the smaller schools. And we've taken those funds and shifted those over to smaller schools throughout the system. And
so what will it look like in a smaller school, an elementary school of 250 kids?
So if you're at 250 kids, you're getting $500 more per pupil than the base itself. So, you know, you take 300 times 500, and that adds up to a large sum of money.
And how is that different from the previous year?
Oops. Do you want to take that one?
So it really, it's because we have so many more. I can get the exact number for you from last year. But because we have so many more segments than we had before, there's factors, yes.
Okay.
It's so many more different groups of factors, so those levels. Let me hold on 1 second, and I'll get you the exact number for that size.
But is it more? I mean, I don't.
Yeah, yeah. More.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. But I think it's an important part. Our thing here to remember is what this is also doing is opening our eyes to the true cost of operating small schools, mm-hmm. right? So that's $500 in this situation. We have up to $700 equity funding. That's $700 just to try and get them to a level playing field as opposed to enrichment or reduced class sizes or additional compensation to attract and retain great teachers in our district. So, I mean, there is a cost to small schools that's very visible to us as a system now that I don't think we had. I think finance understood it, maybe not the rest of us quite as clearly.
Well, this anticipates a discussion we're going to have later on in the evening. If you get down to numbers of 200 kids in a school, it becomes a real struggle to have the minimum educational requirements to achieve the outcomes that you're looking for.
It's similar to what we see at the state level. We as a district have a size factor that takes off some of our funding, and we know the small rural struggle.
So, I know Ms. Harmon had, I wanted to get her to ask her questions.
Yeah, I thought we'd just go around. And I thank you for your presentation, and the timeliness of it for me as a board member is great. I've had the opportunity as a parent to sit through SAC meetings in elementary, middle, and high school as a parent, which is a different lens than a school board member. And so it's been really great for me to look at it that way and take your words back. And it is true, when you have parents that come to your SAC meetings and really can dig in on what that looks like and have their feedback heard and see it implemented, if they keep coming back, it's a real great thing for the school and for principals. Stepping back as a school board lens, I had an opportunity just a few nights ago to sit through a Green Mountain Connection meeting and listen through a different lens of five feeder elementary schools, middle school, and a high school, all of differing sizes, differing experiences. I show up at those meetings and just address if they have questions and what is on our next agenda, and SBB was on the agenda. So it was a really great dialogue. And I heard from a school who, for the first time, went over some numbers and fell into a larger size for elementary and the financial consequence for them with that. And their planning that then went around that before and after, and that it is not an exact science, and learning to address that. That was the first time I'd heard of that as a school board member, looking at that, the flip side of that. Then I heard from smaller schools, and I really appreciate that we are continuing to address the equity and the inequity that exists, and it's a constant challenge. It'll always be there for us. And so kind of some of my questions, looking at middle school and high school, and looking, you know, Wes, your comments about, you know, a size of 830, and that continual challenge, I think, for smaller schools and middle schools of providing that programming and the best staffing, and how does that fit into our model here? I see something for IB, but are there other considerations for programming so that we can offer the courses to as many kids as we possibly can to ensure that enrichment in learning? And is that a consideration in our equities so that all schools have that opportunity to do the programming, which obviously costs money?
Right. And I think there's two things to consider. One is we don't have unlimited resources, so we can't offer all the programs at every site. And I think that is an economic reality. When I was going through Jeffco schools, I think there was a lot more money, and so we had shop, and we had family studies, and we had lots of different ones, and schools are now having to make some of those decisions on what programs are most valued by their community and offer those based upon the limited resources we have as a system. We do give $65,000 to each high school for alternative programming. And then schools are working to secure funds through CTE dollars to get reimbursement for some of the CTE programming they have, concurrent enrollment programming, and those sorts of things. We do offer an IB amount because of some work we're transitioning to SBB. And so we're not pulling away all the supports for all the schools that have been relying on that over the years. And so there's a slow transition process by design for a few schools that could not offer certain programs if they hadn't received those dollars from the centrally allocated model.
Okay. And you know, and the other equity piece that we're all aware of is some schools have greater ability to generate other buckets of money through fundraising. And so then that's the other piece of the turn, and you see the significant importance of trying to create fundraising to backfill some of those things. And I realize we can't solve all of our problems. But I think overall what I hear in my buildings that I try to visit is that there's a real positive for the ability to control those resources because every building is different, every need base is different, and yes, if we had unlimited dollars, what we could do. But what we are doing is great stuff with what we have. And I have to say to all of you and all the principals out there, what a great job you're doing and how complicated it is, and that I encourage all parents to go to as many SAC meetings as you can to get engaged in that process, because I am seeing great things in our schools. And thank you for all that you've done at Dunstan in the time that you've been there as well. The programming is so critical to kids. It really is. So continuing that work at all levels. And I've been to many of your schools, and thank you for all that you're doing.
We're going to skip me, but I reserve the right to have one or two questions. My colleagues usually ask everything I can think of, but Allie, let's go to you.
Okay. Mr. Paxson and Ms. Kirksey, thanks for telling us the population of your school, because to me, that has been the concern of that Brad had already mentioned, and none of you are in my district, so I don't know if you are Title I schools. I don't think you are, and there were concerns at my Title I schools as well that I have visited, and I'm thinking out loud here, so please help me process through this. I feel like what I've heard from my Title I schools is, boy, if we didn't have these Title I monies, we would be sunk. And so what's going through my mind is they're using those Title I funds to sustain instead of offer the extra resources that, and this was last year, not this year, and to, instead of offering the extra resources that those Title I funds were meant for. And if my thinking is wrong, please correct me.
Yeah,
I want to make sure I'm wrong. Yeah. I want to be wrong.
The reality is that often a lot of your Title I schools are small schools as well. Mm-hmm. And so they're, I think they always want additional dollars. And that's the point of the Title I dollars is, here's your foundational educational experience, and then the Title I dollars add to that. And I would say that those Title I dollars have always been that situation. So where we had the centrally allocated model, they got 10 teachers, just like another school that's not Title would have gotten 10 teachers for that population. And then they got the additional Title dollars. So the Title dollars are always in addition to what our base funding is across the system. Do we need and want more? Absolutely. Across the entire system, I think you will see that. That's why, though, on the general fund dollars, we are looking at how do we allocate more back. And that's why you get $700 if you're a really small school from the general fund. Plus, if you're getting the additional Title dollars, you're getting that as well.
Okay. And so do you feel like it's more equitable for those Title schools then?
I think,
because of the
you would define, the equitable is a,
big word.
Is a big word that can mean lots of things to lots of people.
Don't forget they have that.
Right.
Right, and there's, so that you get not only the Title dollars, but then for all your at-risk students, your free and reduced lunch students, there's also an additional $650 per pupil to that. So that school would get the small school allocations we're giving, the additional dollars because they're small.
Okay.
They would get their free and reduced lunch per pupil allocation of $650, and then they would get the Title I dollars added to it as well.
Okay.
As well as any, and I know Mr. Flores and his team often provides some additional supports, literacy interventionists and other supports that come out of his department to support not only all our schools, but a lot of those supports are intentionally directed at some of our Title populations as well.
Okay, thank you.
And one thing.
So as we're budgeting right now, we've been in these meetings with some Title schools, and the achievement directors are asking them to budget all in SBB, pretend you don't have any Title, let's see how you're working right now. So right now we're pretending, even though they know that they're getting Title, we're pretending like they're not getting Title.
Okay.
Is that exercise to see how well they can staff adequate staffing for that school, and then the Title I dollars then are used to supplement to support the challenges of learning challenges that students in poverty
exactly
may face. Okay, have you
not
had
yet
a chance?
And then my next question is about, I think Brad asked you to expand on what exactly is the plateau, because it sounds like that's helped out a lot. If you could describe that to our community, that would be great.
Okay, so the plateau is really for all of our changes in size factors. So, for example, if you have if you're an elementary school and you have 399 kids, you get a size factor of $100. Let's actually go one down. This might be easier. If you're an elementary school at 374 kids, you get an additional $150 per student on top of your regular base factor. But if you were to get a couple extra kids and go up to 376 students, you now only get $100 per student on top. So you're losing that $50 per student. So when you add it all together, you're losing money. So what we wanted to do was keep you steady and keep you there until you start to grow again. So for each size factor level, it's about, depending on the factor, it's anywhere from 2 or 3 students to 10 students before you start to increase money again. So we just hold you flat during that time.
This is complicated, and we have to explain it lots of times over. So in that example, right, the idea was that you're getting $50 less per pupil, but we know at some point you're getting more money. So that's what she's saying, that about 10 more students, even though you have the lower additional factor, your total is a larger sum gain. Last year we didn't have the plateau. So once you went from 150 to 100, you had that change in that factor, you just lost the money. And so schools were literally sitting there going, wow, I had to take 2 kids, they moved into my neighborhood, and now I'm short, you know, $30,000 as a result of those 2 additional kids. So what this, and I think that's the situation you were bringing up earlier.
And seeing it in real life, right. Actual, right. And there's a lot of other factors then when you're looking at choice and you're looking right. at neighborhood schools, and there can be some significant consequences there. Either way, in terms of equities, and you can look at it one way or the other, but it's right. an interesting discussion.
So what we did, the model this year, with the help of principals,
yep.
And our finance team, was to eliminate that loss. Mm-hmm. So you're held at that amount until you get to those 10 additional students that start to get you an incremental additional amount. So you're not ever losing money, mm-hmm. right? But you have the opportunity to gain if you grow 10 rather than 2. Does that make sense?
It does. Mm-hmm. It does.
And that happens on both ends, because mm-hmm. we right. have the large school negative factor to allocate down to the small school. So if you grow from 800 students and you're 350 negative factor to 801, and now you're at a 425 factor, you have that same issue just in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so the plateau kicks in there as well.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for all of your work on this.
Ms. Steven.
So it's been interesting to watch the development of SBB. My first encounter with it was as a parent at a school accountability meeting. And we used to sweat like the FTE rollout, right? How many teachers? Are we going to have to double up? Are we going to have a split grade class? And it did create a lot of flexibility. And I just want to honor the approach, because I think I hear that again and again at various schools, that they've had the opportunity to really dig into what they think is going to be the best solution, the best use of their resources, the best use of their people to serve those needs. And I hear a lot of really innovative thinking. I wish I could go teach one of those electives. It sounds so meaty and great. And I appreciate knowing that you're able to be responsive to the demands that you see your students making for electives or APs, which I know can sometimes be the smaller class sizes, so you've got to be strategic. So kudos. I hear a lot of innovation. I definitely hear that there's that level of transparency, flexibility, autonomy. I'm glad for it. I think it's a system that's working. I think the last time we got an update, we heard 75% of our principals, huge thumbs up. So I want to ask a couple questions that overlap with some of the questions that we've heard, where it does rub. Cheers on the plateau versus a cliff. I listened as a principal sweated out new enrollment that would have taken her over 300, and she was looking at the loss of tens of thousands of dollars, and her budget was going to be broken. So I think that's really smart. And thank you. I think that's responsive as well. Huge jump from just the 2 or 3 to 12. So I take it that we may hear something next year about how that's working out and how those larger schools that are, can we call it something not the negative factor? Because that's just
we can call it resource reallocation.
So it'll be interesting to kind of hear how they're weathering that. And also, you know, my gratitude to the flexibility and the recognition that that scale of economy is working, and being able to use those dollars to serve the smaller schools is good. So I hear a lot from schools that are contracting, that are experiencing the loss of enrollment, and it's not minimal, it's significant. A lot of this is because of the increased housing costs that are driving these families out. And can you talk to me about the timeline for when reallocation happens, when those schools contract? I know they're planning in December, January. They're learning something new in August as enrollment shifts a little bit. and then they're doing official counts in October. How do you weather, especially the contractions where it's going to hurt a school?
So one budget? Of the benefits from this process has been the partnership that's been developed between school sites and our finance and budget team. So we have budget analysts that are working very closely with schools and school leaders. I've been watching meetings occurring throughout the building here, and I know they're going on at school sites, starting with, let's look at your enrollment. What have been the trends? Let's go back and look at what have been the trends the last couple of years. Let's look at your feeder schools. What are we seeing coming up from them? Maybe not only this coming year, but a couple of years behind that. And trying to get a good enrollment projection. We then revisit those on a regular basis throughout the spring. We can open up the budget tool, make adjustments. They go through the summer, as you heard, some of it is on the good side that we've grown and we need additional resources. Well, those additional resources come because at other places we may have contracted and those resources are no longer. If a school loses 30 students, that's a teacher. That class will no longer be, you know, is no
so
longer
it's
there.
Never that clean,
it's
right?
It's never clean. It's never
it's
in
not
any
a class.
System. And that's
it's
what,
three here and three right. there and three there.
And it does and vary. And that's the reality of it. Mm-hmm. That we can't get around, that the old system didn't work either with being good at that. So those adjustments are made. The nice part is that the budget analysts are typically working very closely with the principals, so they're making adjustments throughout the summer and getting conservative, maybe not hiring a position as they're seeing that decline in trend. We have, as you heard in the state, right, Aurora Public Schools was shocked to see the number of students they lost this year and the cuts they're having to make as a result of that. We have that as a microeconomy throughout our system where we've had neighborhoods that are having a similar surprising drop. We were projecting growth and we're seeing drops as a result of migration of housing costs or whatever that is causing those reductions in various areas. So those shocks and surprises, we do work with HR. If we've had several situations this fall where we're able to go and take a teacher at a school that was no longer needed and find a home for that school, for that teacher at another school where there was growth. And so we've made adjustments to help protect budgets through that process. So it is there's no one and done. It is a constant monitoring, and that constant monitoring is in partnership, not just by the school itself, but in partnership with the budget office. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
I did, yeah. So I did want to just add and support what Terry's saying about these budget analysts. That support has really helped us grow through this, and whether that's a contraction or an expansion. I do want to mention that there's some real good thinking that goes into that support. Every year, I'm going to hold back a certain amount of money because my numbers at fifth grade are higher than what I'm going to bring in for a kindergarten class. So every single year, I'm expecting a contraction. I'm preparing for that. Now, if I had a 30-kid contraction, where do I think the benefit of SBB is? In the collaborative decision making. The community still gets that flexibility to try to decide what to do. But every year I'm planning for probably 10 kids less than I had because of the number of kids going out of fifth grade and the number of kids coming in kindergarten. And when we actually get those numbers back, boy, you've got more funds and you can do something extra with that. And if you don't quite get that number, you had planned for it early anyway. So this process really does, you mentioned it, that level of flexibility. And let's not forget, even if there's a contraction, you still get that collaboration with your community.
It's interesting, I've seen in the discussions I've had with people that their personalities are reflected in the numbers that they choose to budget. Because some, the more conservative they, well, you know, if catastrophe happens and I lose 60 kids, I'm not going to budget for them. And others are going to be a little more comfortable and budget up to the line. I also think that some of the principals are using this a little bit as a piggy bank. So they feel like they're going to build up some funds so they can afford a resource in the future. And you might want to speak to that as well, because some of the solutions that our schools are talking about are expensive.
And that's no small matter when we know that about $7 million, if I'm remembering correctly, are being held right now and not spent.
Right.
And yeah. Some of that's conservative principles, some of that's because they have a planned purchase. So can you speak to, when we know that we're facing significant budget challenges, how do we make sure that we don't have dollars that are not liquid to meet the needs of our kids now.
The $7 million was the increase to school carry forwards that We didn't expect this last year. So we do have a listing of all those carry forwards. The budget team is who calculates that. And again, it's important to look at that carry forward amount in perspective to their total budget. And so we kind of look at a 5%. You know, if they're over 5%, then we want to know what they're planning to do with that carry forward and if they have a plan. Is it a multi-year purchase they're saving for, that sort of thing? Because we don't think it's bad to have reserves at each school for emergencies, like if the enrollment changes. But we do want to make sure they're aware of it and planning appropriately. I know that when we see requests come in to the capital department for needs at a school level, say that they would like additional video cameras installed, one of the first things we do is look at their carry forwards and say, well, how much, you know, do you have at the school level before we start putting forth other funds? So we constantly are reviewing that.
So I'm going to ask a question that probably will come to no surprise to Terry and Kathleen, because we've had this conversation before. And I really appreciate the approach you're taking with Title I schools to say, preserve those dollars to meet the needs that are unique to a Title I population. I serve in a district where a number of our schools are our highest poverty density schools. They took a bit of a hit when the shift was made last year from $8.20 per free meal child to $6.50 per free and reduced meal child. These are also some of those contracting schools because gentrification is pushing many of those families out. They can't afford to live there anymore. And then I come to the kindergarten issue. Right now with an SBB, kindergarten is a revenue stream that really benefits schools in which their community has more, a higher percentage of their families choosing and paying for full-day kindergarten, whereas we have many of our schools where the free and reduced lunch provision that allows those students to access, as it should, and I love that we do it, full-day kindergarten, that becomes a hit to their SBB budget. I want to know that innovation and flexibility exists in every one of our schools, and I worry that flexibility and flexible dollars are limited twice over because of that kindergarten factor, that we capture for some of our school communities that are least poverty impacted, some real flexible dollars for innovation. And in those schools where they are most poverty impacted, there are the fewest dollars for flexible, innovative thinking around their budget. Can you speak to that?
I think this will, until we fund full-day kindergarten district-wide, you will have this, and you had it for years. When I was an elementary principal, the students at my school, the percentage of free and reduced population that I had were not in full-day kindergarten because I was not a school that got to offer it, and so I had to charge for all of my population. Now, I had a lot of people paying, and so the term you use is revenue stream, and the district actually at one point in time finally went to a consistent fee across the district because we had a wide range of what people were charging for free and for full-day kindergarten, and we brought that into a consistent fee structure district-wide. And so what I saw from my end with a smaller population of free and reduced lunch students is they couldn't access free full-day kindergarten. And really, I would argue, could have benefited from it. Now what we've done as a district, we said anybody who needs that from a free and reduced lunch perspective can access it because we've moved it with this change in the way we approach full-day kindergarten. I don't think this is a problem that can easily be resolved unless we simply go across the district and say we will fund that. And there's obviously cost and benefits to that. So that means a school that has had some supplemental funds created because they had larger full-day kindergarten classes and everybody paying their fee for that class versus those schools that maybe didn't have everybody paying for it. Again, that is, as you know, my perspective is I like the fact that every kid who needs access to it gets it, even if they're a smaller percentage of the total student population served at that school.
Well, and I would argue that I would love to believe we may not be there. I hope that every child that needs full day kindergarten gets it. I think right now we do have one line, and that's the free and reduced lunch line, as to whether or not a family gets to access that at cost or at no cost. What I do think it is a great example of is where district-wide initiatives are necessary, that the flexibility of school-level decisions with a budget is great. But we have neighboring districts, one in particular, that has found a way to create a sliding scale provision for kindergarten that allows families to access it at a point that is hopefully achievable. But it's the kind of district-wide initiative that I think I would welcome. an exploration of how do we create solutions that are shared. Similarly, whereas Mr. Paxton at Conifer can respond to the kinds of demands that students' elective choices are making or their AP choices, my hope is that we're also aspirational, that we may have some higher density poverty populations where they aren't already, thanks to their families or to their future ambitions, planning to take some AP courses, but that we're growing what we believe are the kinds of concurrent enrollment or AP choices, or the access that since not if we cannot afford to offer shop in every school, that there's some sense of geographic access. I think that SBB is a great model. It's one that you all, I think, are working brilliantly, and I hope we sustain it. But I think it also doesn't limit the necessary and important opportunities for district-level decision-making and initiatives that can address some of these bigger challenges.
I would agree with that, and I would actually use the example of CELS, the social-emotional learning specialists, as an example of exactly what you're talking about that we implemented this year.
Yeah. Thank you.
Our bell-to-bell clinic aids, which is the other example thrown at me, yes.
I think we got to most of my two questions. I would like to say that I really like the plateaus that you've introduced. I think they're helpful to our schools. I think they're a great thing. The other thing I'm enjoying about this presentation on SBB 3.0 is that it appears to me that what we have going here is a continuous improvement process. You know what? That's a great thing. And ultimately, if it is good today, we can make it better tomorrow. I really like that concept. I'm going to at least say this. Years ago, I remember a time when the district used to have sort of a – and I don't know that this is the way to do it, Terry, but they used to have years ago a centralized sort of innovation fund. And I'm not talking about a fund that would fund full-day kindergarten. That's a different question. If we're going to do that, if we could find the money and have the resources, we could do that district-wide. But I'm talking about much smaller, innovative things. And so is there any provision that would allow a school to come to you and say, you know, we've run across this special program we think is perfect for our kids, and guess what? It's got a price tag we can't afford.
We are working through that. We've got a couple of partners that are helping us think that and trying to find ways to fund, because what we want to make sure is it's a sustainable plan. So if a school wants to take something new on, and maybe we help them for a couple of years while they build to a sustainability point, is what we're really looking at doing. Because if we just offer it, and then the minute we pull back the funding and give it to somebody else, the program goes away, that's not good for anybody else. So that's what we're trying to roll this out in a way that, you know, we can identify, make decisions, because I guarantee you there's going to be, every one of these people will be filing a request, as well as about 150 other schools. So we're working towards that. We're not ready for prime time quite yet.
And thank you. All I wanted to say, was if we were thinking about it, you know what? I'd like to have the money to run our school district today that we had when we used to have that fund. And as a high school principal, I tapped it once or twice. But that was back in about the 1980s somewhere. And let me tell you what, we had money to run a great educational program back then, and I know we've lost a lot since.
But I would close with this. We are running a great educational system in Jeffco because of not only these individuals that are up here with me, and I mean all of our individuals, our district partners as well as our school leaders, and all of our school leaders throughout the district that are taking this and doing everything they can with the limited resources to ensure we continue to deliver that vision for all our students and all our buildings as best we can. So thank you for your time, and I appreciate the school leaders being here tonight as well.
Thank you, Terry and Kathleen and the principals. Thanks for being here. And Terry, you have to let me get away with saying that we need additional funding in Jeffco schools. I'm going to keep saying that until somebody listens.
And I want to thank Amanda for continuing to bring up full-time kindergarten, and that's an important thing we need to keep talking about as well.
Yes, we do.
Okay, with that, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to take a break now before we begin our formal meeting this evening. So we will get back together in 7 minutes. Let's do that.